I'd like to call to order this meeting of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Welcome, everybody. Hope you're enjoying the what appears to be spring. So good to have you all here. The first order of business will be to call the roll. Ms. Niedernhofer?
Liebling.
Present.
Hewitt.
Present.
Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Ackland.
Ackland, present.
Backer.
Backer, present.
Bonner.
I'm on a Zoom meeting and I gotta say I'm present.
Bonner. Bierman.
Present.
Bolden.
Present.
Demuth.
Present.
Freiberg. Freiberg. Grunhagen.
Present.
Heel.
Present.
Morrison.
Present.
Munson. Excused. Pryor.
Present.
Quam.
Present.
Ryer.
Present.
Schultz.
Present.
Wolgemuth.
Present.
A quorum is present.
All right, thank you. And I think I saw Representative Bonner. I think she was having technical difficulties, but don't worry, members, if you sign in, we'll catch you for the roll anyway. So that's just fine. Okay, so the next order of business is to approve the minutes of March 3rd. And there was a corrected copy sent out recently.
Madam Chair, I'm present. I can move the minutes.
Wonderful. Thank you, Representative Freiberg. Representative Freiberg moves approval of the minutes of March 3rd, 2021. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, if members would please unmute yourselves for just a moment. All in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Thank you, Representative Freiberg. First bill on the agenda today, House File 1412, Representative Morrison. And this would be a motion to, the first engrossment. So the motion would be to move the first engrossment of 1412 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. Is that your motion, Representative Morrison?
My motion, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay, wonderful. And then you have two amendments. Did you want to introduce the bill first, or what is your pleasure with regard to the amendments?
I can introduce, Madam Chair, the amendments as part of my presentation of the bill, or at your pleasure.
Well, why don't you go ahead and introduce the bill as it is, and then I know at least one of them kind of adds a new element. And why don't you just introduce the bill and then we can do the amendments after. Just don't let me forget.
Madam Chair, thank you. Madam Chair and members, I am pleased to present House File 1412, the Minnesota Telehealth Act. Telehealth is not new. The existing Telemedicine Act was passed in 2015 with broad bipartisan support.
And Representative Morrison, excuse me for one second. I think we're having a little trouble hearing you, at least I am. Can you increase your volume a little bit? Are other people having trouble, or is it just me? Yeah, you are. Okay. Thank you. Please continue.
Madam Chair, my volume is cranked up. Is that better?
Yes, it is. Thanks.
Okay, my apologies. Telehealth is not new. The existing Telemedicine Act was passed in 2015 with broad bipartisan support, and the modality has been used effectively. But there is no doubt that one of the silver linings of the COVID-19 pandemic, if that is possible, has been the greatly increased use of telehealth and telephone visits to provide patient care. Use of telehealth went from less than 2% of visits in 2019 to nearly 30% of visits in June of 2020, according to an MMA survey that is in your packets. It has helped people receive care during the pandemic, and many have recognized that the advantages this option creates for patients expanding access to underserved communities, increasing convenience, and saving patients time and money. I want to highlight several important points about the bill. One, the bill uses the term telehealth instead of telemedicine. This is a broader term that reflects how these services are being used. Much of the bill is rewriting existing law that uses the term telemedicine and changes it to telehealth. Secondly, it redefines originating site to allow patients to be provided care wherever the patient is located, including their home. It meets patients where they are, literally. Third, the bill removes an arbitrary limit of 3 telehealth visits per week that exists for medical assistants enrollees. It also includes telephone-only services in the definition of telehealth if those services are part of a scheduled patient appointment and the standard of care for that service can be met through audio-only communication. I think it's important to note that nothing in the bill requires patients or providers to use telehealth. The provider has the right and responsibility to determine if telehealth is appropriate, and a patient has the right to choose not to receive care through telehealth. And I think that maybe I'll wrap up there and we can talk about the amendments if you like, or I can walk through the bill, Madam Chair.
Representative Morrison, I think we could go ahead and take the amendments. Which one would you like to move first?
Let's see, why don't we move the A3 amendment first?
All right, Representative Morrison moves the A3 amendment. Would you like to go ahead and describe that?
Yes, please. The A3 adds a study to impact the impact of this legislation. So it will look at whether or not it reduces health disparities and how it works in providing equitable access to underserved communities. And also its impact on value-based payments, which was a concern of some of the health plans and some in the business community. And that study would be reported in the early in the year 2025 to the legislature.
Okay, thank you, Representative Morrison. So on the A3 amendment, do members have questions or discussion to the A3? Okay, I'm not seeing any. And just a reminder, members, that the bill will be laid over. So, nothing's permanent here. If we need to, say, tweak a date or something like that, certainly we could always do it. So, all right, with that, if you would unmute yourselves, members, all in favor of adoption of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails, the A3 is adopted. And then we have the A4 amendment. Would you like to move that one, Representative Morrison?
Yes, please, Madam Chair.
All right, Representative Morrison moves the A4 amendment. Would you like to describe that one?
Yes, Madam Chair, the A4 amendment specifically adds some members of the substance use disorder treatment team to the bill.
Okay. Any questions from members or discussion to the A4 amendment? All right. Seeing none, if you would unmute, please. All in favor of adoption of the A4 amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Okay. I don't know if it's necessary to walk through the whole bill. It is kind of a long bill. And just to Representative Morrison, before we go to questions, or we have testifiers, we have quite a list of testifiers. So we'll do those before we take questions. But before we do that, Representative Morrison, anything more you want to say just by way of introduction?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I would say that we've learned many things over this past year. And one of them is the positive addition of telehealth services to the healthcare toolbox. As we confront the healthcare disparities that exist by race, geography, and economic status, as well as the mental health and substance use disorder crises that we face in Minnesota, telehealth will be an important modality to help tackle them.
All right. Thank you, Representative Morrison. So we have a list. I have seven people on my list, and I'm just going to mention them in order first so that they know, they probably do know where they come in the order, but so everyone knows. So we have Dr. Sarah Manny, then we have John Magnuson, then Jessica Young, Bentley Graves, Dan Andreessen, Dave Renner, and Dan Dwight. So we will go to Dr. Sarah Manny. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Liebling. My name is Dr. Sarah Manny, and I serve as Essentia Health's Chief Medical Information Officer, and I'm also a pediatrician in Duluth. On behalf of the Minnesota Hospital Association and Essentia Health, I respectfully request your support of House File 1412. Essentia Health is an integrated health system serving patients in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and North Dakota. And since March 2020, Essentia Health has conducted approximately 389,000 virtual visits directly to patients, with almost 40% of these being offered over the telephone. During this time, the virtual visits have allowed Essentia Health to conduct over 80% of its mental health encounters, avoid countless ER visits, and save patient lives. While the number of virtual visits has leveled off since the early months of the pandemic, virtual visits still account for roughly 20% of Essentia's encounters and will remain an important tool to ensuring access to care throughout the rural and underserved communities we are privileged to serve. As a pediatrician, I have experienced the overwhelming benefits of virtual visits firsthand. And my very first virtual visit back in the end of March last year was an amazing one. I was doing a follow-up virtual visit with a mom and an infant who had recently been discharged from the hospital. And as I was talking with the mom and the infant in her home, I could see that the child was deteriorating rather quickly over the last several hours. I truly believe that that technology saved her life, because if she were to have to drive to my office, come in, and I would have to call for an ambulance to transport her to the ER, I think the outcome would have been different. And instead, I was able to get the child to a higher level of care really quickly, and she's doing well today. I've also been able to provide many mental health visits through virtual care, but one in particular stands out. It was a teenager who I'd seen for many years, but had only seen one of her parents because they'd have to take the whole day off of work to drive to my office from rural Minnesota. I was able to do the virtual visit with both the parents there, and their church provided the broadband internet that was needed for the visit and also a private room. So it was a wonderful time to be able to come up with a plan for the child's care with both patients there. So I've seen just firsthand how these virtual visits can really affect the healthcare of our families and our children. And so they're just a few examples of how I can leverage the benefits for virtual visits. So for these reasons, we ask that the committee support House File 1412, and thank you for your time and consideration.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Manny. John Magnuson, welcome. And you're muted, Mr. Magnuson.
Of course, and thank you for the coaching, Chair Liebling. Thank you, Chair Liebling, and members of the committee, and thank you for the privilege of testifying before you today. My name is John Magnuson, and I'm the Executive Director of MARCH, the Minnesota Association of Resources for Recovery and Chemical Health. MARCH is a professional association of addiction treatment and professionals and organizations that strive to raise awareness about addiction and the power of recovery. We represent more than 75 agencies and a workforce of more than 5,000 individuals with members in every region of Minnesota. The goal of MARCH is to improve access to quality behavioral health services for all Minnesotans who need support and share the value of long-term recovery to the individual, family, and the communities we live in. During this pandemic, overdose deaths surpassed those experienced during the height of the opioid epidemic in 2018 and spiked 20% higher than rates in 2019. According to Minnesota Management and Budget, revenues from addiction-related goods were up nearly $37 million more than predicted in July through September. And concurrently, people who already struggle with access to social determinants of health, such as stable housing and food supports, are experiencing outsized disparate impacts. While telehealth does not address all these needs, it has become essential to the way in which providers deliver services in the state of Minnesota. Prior to the pandemic, the costs of equipment, training, and technical expertise limited the ability of our provider community to use telehealth with our clients. When the governor declared our workforce essential, our frontline professionals quickly found ways to incorporate telehealth into practice with clients. The usage of telehealth was amplified to great effect during the pandemic, and we now utilize these tools effectively in treatment for all SUD disorders and co-occurring mental health disorders. But this was only possible due to the federal and state funds provided as a part of COVID relief, which is only sustainable if rate parity for telehealth continues. Otherwise, we'll be unable to absorb the additional costs of ongoing hardware, software, and technology upgrades. The following three issues highlight the key benefits of telehealth for our professionals. One, access. Telehealth is proven to reduce barriers. It's more convenient for clients, helps to overcome historic disparities with BIPOC individuals, aids mothers and children, and improves access for individuals in rural areas. Two, workforce. Telehealth supports our workforce by extending the reach of professionals and more easily incorporating mental health professionals into the care we provide. And three, sustainability. Telehealth allows us to keep clients connected to treatment and supports longer and supports improved client outcomes when clinicians and clients are allowed to use the tool's flexibility between both in-person and telehealth. Therefore, March appreciates very greatly the work of Representative Morrison and others on HF 1412, and we look forward to continuing to work with her and the committee on this important legislation. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Magnuson. Jessica Young.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today on House File 1412. My name is Jessica Young, and I'm a policy and advocacy manager at the Medical Alley Association. We are the cross-sector healthcare association in Minnesota that supports and advances Medical Alley's global leadership in health innovation and care. We want to thank Representative Morrison for her leadership on this issue. We'd like to thank the bill author also for substituting the word telehealth for telemedicine throughout this bill. This is an important update in terminology that more accurately reflects the reality of virtual care delivery. We also appreciate the expanded definition of originating site to the location of the patient when they are provided telehealth. We are thankful for the inclusion of telemonitoring, as clarity on the coverage of telemonitoring is a significant priority for both our members and for their patients. Both of these changes will be beneficial to patients as they will allow them to access quality, clinically appropriate care safely from where they are located. We appreciate the modification to the definition of telehealth that the author has included. We do, however, believe that the definition of telehealth outlined in House File 1411 may be a better approach. We support the addition of language clarifying that value-based arrangements or payment models are not bound by the payment parity portion of this legislation. It is important to provide clarity to plans, providers, and innovators that these types of forward-looking care models can operate in the way that makes most sense for patients. We do have concerns with the language in the bill that limits a patient's ability to access health networks that do not include network providers who provide in-person care for the same service. This language could inhibit the development of innovative care models or other care plans that are able to deliver high-quality care for a lower cost in certain situations. Medical Alley Association, on behalf of our over 600 members, looks forward to continued conversations with the bill author on this legislation. And we again want to say thank you to Representative Morrison for bringing the bill forward.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Young. Bentley Graves, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Bentley Graves. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I want to thank Representative Morrison for the dialogue that we've been able to have with her about this bill thus far and for a number of the changes that she's already made. We survey our members every year on a whole host of issues. And this summer and fall, one of the questions we asked them was, given not just the pandemic, but the trends that they're seeing and the coverage they offer and the demands from their employees, what, if any, changes were they planning to make as it related to telehealth benefits? And fully a third came back and said, this is something that they were looking to put more emphasis on in their plan design going forward. And I think that's both for reasons of access, but also for the promise of cost containment that comes along with telehealth as well. We do share some of the concerns about the bill that Ms. Young articulated thus far. We have concerns about the bill's language as it relates to virtual networks and the impact that could have both in limiting the innovative plan design that we're starting to see in other parts of the country that really leverage telehealth in plan design in the commercial market that allows for products to be offered at a lower cost, but also to the extent that it might pull back on services that Minnesota consumers are already enjoying, things like Doctor on Demand and other similar services. And we have real concerns that the language as it stands today would not just limit the use of virtual networks, but could pull options like that back from the way that they're offered today to consumers. And then similarly, as Ms. Young mentioned, you know, we want to make sure that this bill doesn't put up any impediments around the continued march forward of value-based plan design, value-based payment arrangements. You know, this is something that we and others believe, you know, can and hopefully will bring not just lower costs, but also greater outcomes for patients. And would like to make sure that there's language included in the bills that moves forward that makes clear allowances for that. And I just want to take a quick minute to acknowledge the study language that was added by amendment. This is something we just kind of caught up with today, but we think that this really brings in an interesting element into the discussion about this bill. And you know, we would very much like the opportunity to continue talking.
Mr. Graves, I think we lost you there.
Yeah, I
think
you said Representative Morrison. Figure out how to leverage something like that to. Can you hear me?
Well, you're cutting in and out, Mr. Graves. Okay. So I think you're just about done anyway. So, but thank you for
we'll
that.
We'll leave it at that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, and Mr. Graves, before we leave you, I'm not quite sure if you gave a full introduction. We know you so well that maybe it went by us. But could you just state your name and your affiliation so that it's clear in the record?
Oh, my apologies, Madam Chair. I'm Bentley Graves with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce.
Okay, thank you. You may have said it and I may have just missed it. But anyway, thank you. Okay.
Thank you.
Dan Andreessen.
Members of the committee, my name is Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. The delivery of healthcare has changed since the legislature last debated telehealth policy 6 years ago. Technology has advanced, providers have adopted the technology, and patients have access to care at a time and place that works for them. I want to be clear, the council fully supports the ongoing use and expansion of telehealth for all Minnesotans. The council supports most of the language in House File 1412, but is opposed to language which mandates payment parity and places restrictions on virtual networks. We believe there is a significant potential for telehealth to lower overall healthcare costs. However, that will not be possible under this bill because consumers are mandated to pay for telehealth, whether it be video or phone, at the same higher rate as an in-office visit. Here's an example from one of my members. Without mandated payment levels, a patient would pay around $60 for an appointment over the phone because there was flexibility for payers to negotiate appropriate payment with providers. Under mandated payment levels, that phone call is considered an equivalent to an in-person visit. So they would pay the in-person rate for that phone call, which is $150. Telehealth has been a positive tool during the pandemic, and we're not seeking any changes while under the public health emergency. However, as we emerge from the pandemic, we believe mandated payment parity should end so savings can be passed back to consumers in the form of lower out-of-pocket costs. The potential for savings has been illustrated in a recent study from the Commonwealth Fund, as well as the development of virtual networks in other states, which offer lower premiums as much as 20%. Even if there are no savings today, by not making changes to mandated payments, we will prohibit future consideration of operational efficiencies and limiting any benefits that could be realized through new technology. The council urges consideration for payment flexibility so telehealth may be a tool to address increasing healthcare costs and link payments to the value and outcomes provided to the patient, not patient value. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Andreessen. And Dave Renner. Welcome.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Dave Renner, today representing the Minnesota Medical Association and also the Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians in strong support of House File 1412. The goal of physicians is to make sure that patients have access to health care no matter their circumstances. One thing COVID has shown, as Representative Morrison has indicated, that the value of the extended use of telehealth, which has been critical for patients to receive care that they desperately need. Without this bill, many of the expanded coverages for these services will expire in June. Let me be very clear, telehealth is not a substitute for in-person care. It's simply another way of delivering care. Not every type of care can be done via telehealth, but much of it can. That's one of the reasons why it's important that we continue to have the language that says you can't have a telehealth only network, because we don't believe that that would provide the adequate care for patients. As you know, in many parts of the state, we also have real problems with broadband issues. In addition, many elderly patients are not comfortable using computer or smartphones, and there are many patients who cannot afford computers, tablets, or others for video visits. Therefore, telephone-only visits have been a critical piece, and we think need to continue to make sure that patients throughout the state can provide health care. Some have argued that the quality of care delivered through telehealth visit cannot possibly be the same as the quality delivered during an in-person visit. But research tells us a different story. This past July, we did a survey of physicians and found that 84% of physicians reported that telehealth services were meeting the needs of their patients. And more importantly, 83% of patients said they liked and were satisfied with the care they were providing. Telehealth does not reduce the requirement to provide quality care. It does not change a physician's duty to their patient, nor the requirement to meet a standard of care. Current law already requires that insurers pay the same reimbursement for services, regardless of whether in person or via telehealth. House File 1412 just maintains that law. The savings and efficiencies that you hear about telehealth mostly fall to the patient, not the provider. The cost of care to provide telehealth is pretty much the same as in-person care. The professional fee is the same, staffing and scheduled costs are the same, the electronic health records are the same. We believe we should not use this bill to allow insurers to use this bill to just artificially reduce payments they currently make. Just to clarify one thing that Mr. Andreessen said, this bill does not say that patients have to pay the same thing. It says payers must reimburse providers the same amount. They can set up different payment rates for their enrollees. Just a reminder, you need to know that the positive impact of telehealth services have had on patients in your districts, particularly patients in rural and underserved areas. Without the ability to use telehealth from their homes or have telephone-only visits, many of these patients would have been forced to forego the treatment they received. So we strongly support House File 1412 and be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Renner. And finally, we have Dan Dwight. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members. Sincerely, thank you for fitting me in today to testify. a lot has already been said. I'd like to largely echo what...
Could you please introduce who you're representing?
I apologize. My name is Dan Dwight. For the record, I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Business Partnership. We are a membership organization of business leaders from across the state who employ more than 500,000 Minnesotans. As I was saying, I really do appreciate this opportunity to talk. largely echoing what we heard from Ms. Young and Mr. Graves from the chamber. To be clear, we support the aim of this bill and really appreciate the conversations that we've had with Representative Morrison. And I'd like to sincerely thank her for working on this. It's a tough issue, but it's very important. As we've witnessed from the pandemic we're all living through right now, telehealth is very important for maintaining patient access. But beyond that, it's proven to be very good at actually improving patient access. And as we all know, patient outcomes are central to healthcare delivery. The high cost of health insurance and healthcare is a concern for everybody. And we should take this opportunity to explore ways that we can use telehealth to help rein in some of those costs. As an example, value-based care arrangements have proven successful, and we continue to urge their expanded use where appropriate with telehealth. We also need to be very cautious and protect against frivolous and fraudulent overutilization of telehealth services. And it's very clear to me that this is a major concern for everybody involved in this legislation, and I really do appreciate that. You know, technology has really evolved since this bill, since this law first came about in 2015, and it continues to evolve. So because of that, we really should take into consideration the current technology we have in place and what might be in the future when we have conversations about remote patient interaction and remote patient monitoring with a focus on value and patient outcomes. So I stand ready for any questions, but I really appreciate the time and thank you for consideration, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you, Mr. Dwight. I'm gonna go to some member questions, but before I do, I just wanna say that just kind of following on Mr. Dwight's testimony, I have some questions and perhaps concerns about this legislation, but frivolous and fraudulent overutilization is emphatically not one of my concerns. I find that actually a little bit, you know, insulting to our provider community. And I just want to be very clear that yet I think to the degree that anyone has any concern about that, this is the first I've heard of it. So I just want to say, I think we have an excellent provider community in Minnesota, and that would, I have any, and their integrity is not in question here in my mind. Anyway, let's go to Representative Hewitt and then Representative Schultz. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifiers, Mr. Jefferson, I'm sorry, I know you, your council plans, and Mr. Graves. Just real quickly, my question here is that is the, you know, the cost is there, as we heard from Mr. Renner here, about the clinics being the same and the time of the physician, but it really goes to the efficiency of the patient and what the patient is. And I know, as long as I've been involved in healthcare, that if we get the patient to see their physician even for 5 minutes or whatever, we're gonna have better outcomes. I mean, that's analytical, and we're hoping to find that, but how do you argue back with Mr. Renner's argument that the, you know, that they don't have those same costs, because they still do, right? I mean, what's your comments to that?
And I'm sorry, Representative Hewitt, who was that for?
That's to both Mr. Graves and Mr. The council plans.
Okay, Mr. Graves, do you want to take that first?
I meant to let Mr. Andreessen take it first, and happy to answer.
Okay. Okay, he's on the hot seat. Mr. Andreessen, please.
Madam Chair, Representative Hewitt, you know, what I would say, it's not about paying the provider for their expertise less. We agree that they provide a service and have an expertise that should be compensated for. It's that there's other ancillary costs that we think are going to be less. So, for example, if you do a telehealth visit, you're not checking in with a receptionist, you're not having your vitals taken by a nurse, you're not going into a lab, into a room that needs to be cleaned for the next patient. We just think there's some efficiencies there that could be passed down to consumers.
And Mr. Graves, did you want to add anything?
No, I would just add more broadly. I mentioned in my testimony some of these kind of some of these plan designs that are popping up in other parts of the country that are being brought to market at a lower cost, and I think that does kind of demonstrate that there are some efficiencies to be leveraged.
Okay, follow up, Representative Hewitt.
Yeah, just in closing, I really feel that the cost will come down because the patients will get better care, better follow up. And that you will realize this as plans and as employers, that a mixture of both these and the short one, because it's part of the whole care plan, would only do a detriment to the service. So thank you very much for your input. I appreciate it. Madam Chair, I'm done.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hewitt. So I have Representative Schultz, then Ryer, Bonner, and Quam. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank the author for bringing this bill forward. As one of the original co-authors of the 2015 telemedicine legislation to reimburse healthcare using video, we've used it a lot more during the pandemic, and the original intent was to study that 2015 legislation to measure the impact and the reimbursement. So as a health economist, I'm always concerned, like for example, I had a 5-minute visit to refill a prescription. And instead of being able to charge for a 5-minute telehealth visit, they charge for the entire office visit, which is 15 to 20 minutes. So my concern would be, I would like the plans to be able to negotiate with providers to change the unit. And maybe it's the same rate, but the unit is different. Like, can they get reimbursed for a 5 or 10 minute visit and with all of the things that go into that visit, rather than the full cost of a 15 or 30 minute visit. But I think that I'm glad to see that providers are using more technology. it's important to cover the fixed costs of that technology and the infrastructure, but over time, I'd like to hopefully see substituting lower cost services for face-to-face visits. And my other concern would be any additive costs, so additional phone calls or video visits that may provide very little value being used as this, you know, it continues into the future.
All right, thank you, Representative Schultz. So we've got Representative Ryer, Bonner, Quam, and then we're gonna lay the bill over. So, cause we are just a little bit behind here. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to piggyback on Representative Hewitt's question about the virtual versus infrastructure. And to me, one of the pieces that's important to remember is that right now, as we're sitting here, whether or not a provider is contacting the person at the patient's home or whether they are in person, that infrastructure needs to be there, the clinic, the nurses, the people who are doing the cleaning. Right now, they're still part of the system. And so I don't think it's reasonable to say we can have immediate savings. I would like to see that, though, be part of a longer range vision so that as we're looking at clinic or facility development plans going into the future, 5-10 years, whatever the time frame may be, we can re-examine our assumptions on where care will be provided and then really start to realize savings and benefit from the changes. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Ryer. Representative Bonner.
Yeah, I'll try to be really brief because a lot of my concern was very similar to Chair Schultz's concerns as well. And I think we just need to be careful about when we say that there's going to be great savings. There is the potential for savings, absolutely. There's also some additional costs around setting up the infrastructure and the technology. So I think, and to her point, over time, we may see how that bears out, which is why I'm really grateful that the author has added the amendment to add the study onto this piece so that we can really look at what that bears out over time and how that plays out. But I just think we should be very careful about assuming that just because something doesn't happen in office, for example, a substance abuse or a therapy appointment, that should be reimbursed at a lower rate. But also there's some trade-offs in those smaller appointments as well. So certainly wherever we can find ways to cut costs, and I hope that we'll be thoughtful in our feedback and through that study to really look at those options in the future.
All right, thank you, Representative Bonner. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think all of us foresee bifurcation at some point in the future, but what I'm concerned about is with telemedicine, a lot of our facilities are near the border of our state. Some of the facilities, such as the Mayo Clinic, they have a lot of patients from out of state, and there's follow-up, and there's the high probability of additional telemedicine, telehealth activity. I think really the author and this committee need to look at national compacts to allow for compatibility of licensure and cooperation across states. And I know that that isn't key to this bill at this moment, but I think it's something to look at to prevent difficulties. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you, Representative Quam. So we're gonna lay the bill over. Representative Morrison, well, you know, maybe I would just like to make a brief comment that I'm gonna give Representative Morrison the final word here before we lay the bill over. But, you know, I think this has been a great discussion. Thank you to everybody who's contributed to it. I think what it does show us is that there are some issues that we just can't know about yet. And I have great hope for this. I think that the provider community has really worked hard and turned on a dime during the pandemic and really shown that this can have a great deal of value across many different kinds of service. But I also am a little bit concerned that we may be going a bit blind here because we're kind of jumping in with both feet. And I would personally really like to see us have a defined moment at which we come back, have some studies. I hope that a lot of the folks who have spoken here that and the different systems are collecting data however they can on how well this works and where it doesn't work, because I think it's going to be something that we need to look at with a lot more fine of a lens as we go forward. So, you know, I'm kind of thinking that we may want to pick a point to come back and have the legislature reevaluate this at some point. And anyway, that's just my thinking on it. But Representative Morrison, would you like the final word?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you to everyone for this conversation. And I'm grateful to all the testifiers with whom, I think most of whom I have collaborated on this bill with. So I'm grateful for the input. And you all have heard from specific examples of how telehealth has helped patients and their families in a number of different capacities. It's become an essential part of the healthcare toolkit over this past year, particularly. I just think we have a real opportunity here to expand that toolbox by continuing these changes. The savings will be are immediately to the patient by meeting the patients where they are, by saving them time and money. And then, but if we manage chronic conditions better and we're able to access, get care to people who are underserved right now, we will realize overall savings to our entire healthcare system. So thank you again for the opportunity. And with that, I am done. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Representative Morrison, for your work on this bill. House File 1412, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. All right, we're gonna move on now to our review of several bills that have to do with HIV treatment. And we are very pleased to have with us today George Constantinides, I hope I'm pronouncing it right, and from Hennepin Healthcare to talk with us a little bit and give us a brief introduction into this issue, because these bills we're going to be hearing have to do with HIV, its treatment, how it should be treated, and some of the issues in that space. So welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is George Constantinides, and it's an honor to be here with you today. I'm a pharmacist at Hennepin Healthcare, or HCMC, in downtown Minneapolis. Over the past 10 years, I've had the privilege of providing direct medical care to patients living with HIV. Our clinic, the Positive Care Center, serves approximately one in four patients living with HIV in the state of Minnesota. Positive Care Center aims to deliver healthcare for both HIV and primary care conditions. And as a result, we often have the opportunity to care for patients over many decades. I was asked to speak today to provide some background on HIV medications to the committee. Human immunodeficiency virus, often known as HIV, is a chronic progressive illness that results in harm to the immune system. Because our immune system plays a pivotal role in protecting us each and every day, patients living with HIV who are not on appropriate HIV treatment run the risk of becoming sick. Unlike other illnesses, once a patient has become infected with HIV, there is no cure. HIV medicines work to decrease the amount of HIV virus in the body. Doing so has a number of benefits, including strengthening the immune system, reducing the incidence of secondary diseases of the heart and kidneys, and lastly, decreasing the risk of HIV transmission. Thanks to the potent medicines used today, we now realize that getting the HIV virus count low indeed helps with HIV transmission. Selecting an HIV medicine for a patient remains both an art and science. It is critical patients are able to take their medicines each day, manage side effects, and avoid interactions with other medicines. In many ways, HIV care diverges in two directions, prevention and treatment. From the standpoint of prevention, we are either focusing on reducing the risk of known exposures. This is often referred to as pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP, or working to reduce transmission following an exposure, a known exposure. This is referred to as post-exposure prophylaxis, or PEP. Both prevention interventions are accomplished the same way, prescribing HIV medicines to patients. In the case of PrEP, patients take a single tablet of HIV medicine each day, effectively reducing their risk of transmission if exposed. For post-exposure prophylaxis, patients take HIV medicines for a finite period of time following an exposure. Starting these medicines as soon as possible after that exposure is paramount to their effectiveness in prevention of HIV infection. Switching gears to treatment, there are two major foci for this element of care. The first is early access to HIV medicines for those who are newly diagnosed with HIV. For clinics like the Positive Care Center at HCMC, there are few lengths that we will not go to get a patient in promptly for their very first visit after diagnosis. Data suggests that starting HIV medicines within 2 weeks of diagnosis is especially important. This first visit often involves a provider, a pharmacist, a social worker, and financial support staff, just to name a few. Our goal is to start HIV medicines during the initial visit. The second major HIV treatment foci is medication support for patients as they age. Medicines for HIV patients, the medicines that we prescribe for patients living with HIV help them to live for many decades. Ultimately, the medicine a patient takes in their 20s might not be the medicine that they take in their 60s. Our responsibility as healthcare professionals remains to assure we are selecting the best medicine for each patient at all stages of life. Patients struggle with medicine access for lots of reasons. Some patients do not have insurance or have insurance that requires arduous prior authorizations. Some insurance plans have limited formularies, which makes it more challenging to find the right medicine for each patient. Cost is a consideration for patients as well, with out-of-pocket cost for HIV medicines being a possible reason why a patient might not be able to take their HIV medicines. Lastly, our healthcare system is complex, and at times, patients simply cannot navigate their way. A shared goal of stakeholders in providing care to patients living with and working to prevent HIV is reliable and consistent access to HIV medicines. The three bills before you today have the ability to improve access for both HIV treatment and prevention in Minnesota. Your support today will directly impact the lives of patients currently living with HIV, as well as have a positive impact on increasing access to the critical medicines used to prevent this infection. Thank you for the opportunity to share this information today, Madam Chair, and I'm here to answer questions if there are any.
Thank you so much, Mr. Constantinides, and really appreciate your sharing that with us today. And I don't know if, I think we probably need to get to the bills. If you do have time to stay around, that would be really great. The one thing, just quick question I have for you. What's happening in terms of HIV prevalence or incidence in the state? Are we seeing difficulties controlling HIV in our population?
This is a great question, Madam Chair. And I think one of the challenges that we have at answering that is that our providers throughout the state are doing such a great job of testing for HIV. So because we're testing more often, we're able to identify patients, especially earlier in their disease course, to try to help to get them in for those initial visits, get them on meds, and control the immune system. I think the general consensus is that we're seeing a decline. The more important thing that we're doing is getting patients in to be on HIV medicines, because we're learning so much about how HIV treatment itself is a form of prevention.
All right, well, thank you so very much. All right, so we're gonna move now to House File 745. Representative Hornstein is here with us. And since he's not on the committee, the chair will move that House File 745 be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. Welcome, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members. I'm very pleased to present House File 745 to the committee. House File 745 protects people living with HIV in Minnesota by exempting medications for the prevention or treatment of HIV from medical assistance and Minnesota Care copayments. It removes barriers to care and increases access to HIV medications to ultimately end HIV in Minnesota. And I would add, Madam Chair and members, that while the infection rate has flattened in recent years, we do anticipate an uptick this year. There have been several areas that we're seeing. So when the data comes out soon, I think you will see an increase in the rate in here in Minnesota. So what does the bill do? It establishes a program to assist HIV related to drug copay and lab costs for low-income individuals. It exempts medications for the prevention and treatment of HIV from medical assistance and Minnesota care copayments. It ensures that no person living with HIV in Minnesota loses access to life-saving medication because of a copayment requirement. It ensures that no one is forced to choose between paying for HIV medications or food. We see that quite often. It provides access to antiretroviral medications, and people living with AIDS can achieve and sustain undetectable status or viral suppression. It provides access to pre-exposure prophylaxis and post-exposure prophylactics to prevent new HIV infections. And finally, Madam Chair, in 2018, 64% of people living with AIDS were virally suppressed. And these changes to co-payments, we can see the number increase and more people reach an undetectable viral level. So with that, Madam Chair, I do have several testifiers and would be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Hornstein. So we have... I have three people on the list and then one who's there, I think, to answer questions if necessary. So we're going to start with Dr. Kasten. Welcome to the committee.
Hi, thanks so much for allowing me to speak and just lend my voice in support of this bill. So I'm an infectious disease physician. I work at Mayo Clinic in the HIV clinic, but I'm not here as a representative as Mayo. I just wanted to offer my own support. So I've been taking care of people living with HIV or at risk of acquiring HIV for over 30 years. And those of you who are my age know the amazing strides that we've made with this disease because of the fact that we have great treatment, as has been well voiced by others on the call. Not only do we have great treatment, we also have medication that is once a day that can prevent HIV infection. If we can keep people who are HIV infected on treatment, and as was mentioned, virologically suppressed, then they cannot transmit HIV to others. So not only are they going to stay healthy, but this is a public health matter, right? We don't want other people to get infected. And so although, yes, medications can be expensive in the long run, it's less expensive to keep people on treatment, make sure they don't infect to others, and to make sure that people who recognize that they're at risk, are interested in taking a preventive medicine, can also stay on preventive therapy. So I would say that not only does this bill, if it's passed and we eliminate copays, not only benefit patients who are infected or trying to prevent getting infected, it also benefits society. I know that the copays to some might seem small, but as has already been voiced, for some of our patients, this is a major barrier. If they go to the pharmacy and try to pick up their medication and they have a copay of $10, $25, that might not be anything for those of us on this call, but for them, they may not be able to afford that. They're going to say, you know, I have other things that are more important for me, like buying formula for my kid or buying diapers for my kid rather than staying on my HIV medications or on my PrEP. And so, therefore, I just want to really put my voice out there as in support of this bill, and I thank you for giving it good consideration.
Thank you very much, Dr. Kasten. We appreciate you being here with us today. I have Val Rubin Rashad Crutcher. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Valerie Rubin Rashad Crutcher, and I'm the Executive Director of the Youth and AIDS Projects. We are a nonprofit housed in the University of Minnesota Department of PEDS. We also offer medical case management, HIV prevention services, and sexual health education for those people living with HIV ages 13 to 30. I like to say that many of the people that I work with are unaccompanied and homeless youth. 40% of those young people enrolled in YAP are unstably housed with limited access to resources. Having this particular barrier taken away would make such a huge difference in the lives of people we serve. I've had countless conversations with people over the years, with clients who have foregone getting their medications because they could not afford co-pays for the same reasons that Dr. MJ just listed. This is not just a concern for their physical health and their financial health. I would also argue that it affects mental well-being as well, as I have had clients reported to me that this has affected their mental health as they miss doses. It causes them to not be virally suppressed, which in turn may lead to more HIV positive cases. So again, in removing this barrier and increase access to care, it will help Minnesota move towards their goal of ending HIV. And again, I'll keep it brief, but I want to thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. We appreciate that testimony. We have Megan Williams. Welcome.
Thank you. I am trying to show my video, but I'll begin. Good afternoon. My name is Megan Williams, and thank you for your time today. I'm a registered nurse, and I have a master's in public health. I'm currently the director of nursing and home care services for Claire Housing, which is a nonprofit providing housing and health care to formerly homeless people living with HIV and AIDS. We currently serve over 200 households in the metro area. Over 85% of our residents are engaged in care and virally suppressed, which means that the viral load is suppressed to a point that they cannot pass on their HIV sexually. This success is due to the low barrier supportive housing environment and advocacy Claire Housing provides. I'm here today to say all barriers to accessing HIV prevention and treatment for treatment medications, such as paying co-pays, obtaining prescriptions from providers for PrEP and PEP, and placing life-saving medications on preferred drug lists and requiring prior authorizations should be eliminated. Claire Housing's residents and others in the HIV community utilizing medical assistance face serious financial challenges in paying these co-pays, as we've heard from our other testifiers. HIV medication can range co-pays can range anywhere from $10 to hundreds of dollars a month. And if you are homeless, unemployed, not making a living wage, on medical assistance, and only have $104 to live on a month, people will be forced to making choices, which we have seen before in the community, for paying whether to pay rent, food, or for medications. If barriers continue to be created for people living with AIDS to access life-saving medication, they're at a greater risk of dying, seeking expensive care in the emergency department in our hospitals, and increasing the community viral load and the spread of HIV. Eliminating these barriers are simple public health and fiscally responsible measures that can be implemented to uphold Minnesota's commitment to end HIV and address health inequities. Thank you for your time.
All right, well, thank you very much for your testimony. So I know that Matt Toburin is here for questions. I think we will see, I'm not seeing any questions from members. So, and I'm not aware that we have a fiscal note for this bill yet. But I'm sure that one is in process. Mr. Berg, if you're on, could you just confirm that?
Madam Chair, that's correct. There is a fiscal note request for this bill and the next one. They have not yet been completed.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And so thank you very much to all the testifiers. Thank you, Representative Hornstein. This is one of those bills that, we'll have to see what we have available to spend. And certainly, I think that you've all made an excellent case for this bill. So with that, House File 745 is laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Next, we have House File 855, Representative Hollins.
Hello, Madam Chair. How are you doing? Sorry.
Hello. Good to see you. Welcome. Welcome. So since you're not on the committee, the chair will move that House File 855 be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. So Representative Hollins, please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members. I really appreciate the opportunity to be heard on this bill. This is it's long, but it's fairly simple. Really what we're looking to do is to expand PrEP access, so what we were just talking about, and availability, especially to BIPOC, transgender people, gay and bisexual men, and others at disproportionately high risk for HIV. And we want to do that by authorizing pharmacists to dispense PrEP and PEP without a prescription. As was noted, you currently need to have a prescription in order to get these materials, or to get these medications, rather. And that has proven to be a barrier for a number of people who are at higher risk of contracting HIV and AIDS. It's estimated that only about 10% of the total 1.2 million people who could benefit from PrEP and PEP are potentially receiving that medication. And that pharmacists view prescribing authorities for PrEP and PEP similar to naloxone, oral contraceptions, and vaccine, all of which they can already administer or initiate. Putting PrEP in pharmacies is the next huge step towards ending new HIV transmission rates in Minnesota. In 2018, 286 Minnesotans were diagnosed with HIV. With PrEP and PEP, this number would dramatically decrease by 2025. And I'd also like to note that, especially now we're in the midst of this opioid epidemic, we know that individuals who are using intravenous drugs are at higher risk of contracting HIV and AIDS. And I think making this as easy as possible to access for those higher risk individuals is especially important. I have a couple of folks who are here to testify. I can introduce them, or you can introduce them, whichever is your preference.
All right, thank you, Representative Hollins. I have the list here, so we'll just start with Daniel Jude. Welcome. Please introduce yourself. Tell us who you're affiliated with.
Yes, good afternoon, Madam Chairwoman and committee members. Thank you for this opportunity to share today. My name is Daniel Jude, and I'm a clinical pharmacist working with people living with HIV, along with those at risk of HIV acquisition. I work at North Memorial currently, but I am not representing them today. And thank you, Representative Hollins. I agree with you fully with how critical this is to getting to the end of the epidemic in Minnesota. Back in 2013, I assisted with the creation of the largest PrEP clinic in Minnesota in downtown Minneapolis. I've also created a pharmacy support program within my health system currently at their emergency department to support HIV prevention access. I can tell you from experience that HF855 is a critical piece of the framework necessary to end HIV once and for all in Minnesota. There are established models from Seattle and San Francisco that show that pharmacists can provide PrEP and PEP in a way that increases access to underserved populations. In my clinic, so often patients have complex barriers to care, including transportation, scheduling, and valid, but sadly conflicting priorities. Allowing access to HIV prevention medications at a pharmacy opens wide the opportunity and timing for walk-in patients. Post-exposure as well is time dependent, and so often patients needing post-exposure or PEP are not able to get into and access drugs within that 72-hour window after exposure. So HF855 also includes provisions for training programs that will be created with the blessing of the Minnesota Board of Medical Practice, as well as appropriate requirements to ensure appropriate care coordination with primary care providers. If passed, the law also provides opportunities to connect with high-risk patients to primary care, which is also so important in just keeping patients engaged in their overall care. So I respectfully request your support for HF855 to help end HIV in Minnesota. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, as well as Representative Hollins, for your support.
All right, well, thank you very much, Mr. Jude. Please stay around in case there are any questions, if you're able to. James Talbot.
Hi, thanks, Madam Chair. And members of the committee for having me here to speak today. I'm a Minnesotan here in support of HF855. I'm just here to share my story. About 5 years ago, I actually woke up and got a message that I was exposed to HIV. And I did what any millennial did. I hopped on the internet and did a search and found out that there was something called PEP. Unfortunately, it was the weekend and I had no way to see my doctor. Something that everyone should know about PEP is that you have 72 hours to take the drug for it to be effective. It's about 99% effective, but every hour counts. So that means that each hour, the percentage of you contracting the virus goes up. So, you know, I luckily got it that Monday, and I am HIV negative now, luckily, but, you know, it was a very scary time, and I don't want any other Minnesotan to go through that. I you know, really want you guys to have the opportunity to help extinguish HIV in our lifetime. And I think that's an amazing opportunity for you guys to have. And I hope you vote to bring this to the floor. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Talbot. We really appreciate that. And I don't know if you said your name on the record. Would you mind just stating your name so that we have you on the record?
Sure. I'm James Talbot.
All right. Thank you so much. And then I think we have Mr. Phil Duran. Mr. Duran?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I believe my role is simply to answer questions.
Okay.
If there are any. So I'll defer to members. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. So I have not seen any questions from members yet, but I do have one of my own. And I'll start with you, Representative Holland. So is this the authority for pharmacists to prescribe these medications? Are other states doing this already?
Thank you for the question, Madam Chair. My understanding is that, yes, there are several other states that are doing this already. I would defer to Mr. Duran to confirm this for me, but based on my preliminary research.
Okay, and if we're gonna go to Mr. Duran, I guess I just would ask my my other question, and that would be since, you know, when we think about having pharmacists prescribe medications, I guess the question kind of comes up whether there were any reasons that anyone would be concerned about their ability to do that. For example, if there are certain patients who shouldn't take it, if there are things that, you know, anything that a physician or a advanced nurse practitioner would, you know, would do better, or is this something that is sort of so standard and easy to prescribe, if you will, that we shouldn't need to have any concern about that? Mr. Duran, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And in anticipation of a question you'll ask me at some point, my name is Phil Duran, he, him, his, Director of Advocacy and Research at Just Us Health. We are located in St. Paul with services also in Minneapolis and Duluth. HIV, LGBTQ health, and aging are our key focus areas. Representative Hollins is correct. The language in this bill was based on the statute that was passed in California a couple of years ago. And so it is something that other states are already trying, and as far as I know, without significant problems. With respect to the second question, again, I will also defer back to Representative Hollins. The point of the bill is to give people kind of a bridge, if you will, from right now to the time when they can get to their doctor. So, and I think as Mr. Talbot indicated earlier, that's particularly relevant in the case of post-exposure prophylaxis. You wanna get people get access very quickly. And so, because they may not be able to get into their doctor immediately. And so this is a way to get them from here to there. And both the PEP and PrEP sections of the legislation explicitly create a framework where the pharmacist who's making this, who's providing the medication, is then connecting people to, referring them back to their primary care providers, or providing a list of people who would be appropriate. So I don't think in either of these cases is the intent that this is an ongoing without limit arrangement. It's for here, it's for now, and then here, get to your doctor for appropriate follow-up in both contexts. I hope that answers your question.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for that. Representative
Munson. Another...
Oh, sure. Representative Hollins, go ahead, and then I'll go to Representative Munson.
And I just wanted to add, thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to add one thing to what Mr. Duran said, which is all the pharmacists would have to go through a specific training on what the needs are. There has to be testing regarding somebody's HIV standing before any prescription is provided. So it's not like you just roll up to somewhere and say, hey, I want this, and you get it automatically. Folks have to be trained for what to look for and what to be cautious about, I think, to your point. And also, you have to have that current HIV test.
All right. Thank you. Representative Munson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Hollins, it's an interesting bill. I certainly support allowing pharmacists to prescribe more than they, or to dispense more than they can today. I think it gives people greater access and it lowers costs. One of the questions I have on this bill is I see there's a difference between, let me get the terminology correct, the pre-exposure prophylaxis and post-exposure prophylaxis. And I understand that if someone believes they've been exposed, that time is of the essence and very important that they get access to this drug. But the pre-exposure prophylaxis sounds like it may be something that would be an ongoing cost, or where someone would have to be really on a prescription for this over time, or maybe not a prescription since we're just allowing pharmacists to dispense it. But can you speak to the cost of this drug for the pre-exposure prophylaxis, if that's an ongoing thing, and then also just the cost of the post-exposure drugs? And because I see there's not a fiscal note on this bill.
Right. And Representative Munson, there will be a fiscal note, as Mr. Berg explained, there is one ordered. So, but of course, we can't assume that everyone would be covered by public programs either. So, yeah, Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Munson, for that question. I think it's a fair question. I was going to mention that there is a fiscal note that is currently in process, but we don't have the results of it right now. And I'm going to defer to Mr. Duran on the cost, because I do not have any firsthand experience with this particular prescription.
Mr. Duran.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Munson. So I'm going to defer to Mr. Jude. But here's what I can tell you. Representative Munson, you distinguish between the two medications, and that's absolutely correct. So typically, the PEP, post-exposure prophylaxis, the idea is a person's taking it for a discrete period of time, and presumably it's over and done with. PrEP is a different thing. A person could start on this and be on it for an indefinite period of time. And what motivates a person to take PEP is the concern that they may have just experienced an infection. The person who is looking at taking PrEP is motivated by a concern that there may be an infection in their future. And so their interest in taking PrEP may extend until that situation changes, if at all. In terms of cost, PrEP is not cheap. And this is the specific area question about the cost of it. I'm looking at Mr. Jude, and hopefully he will chime in, because I think his knowledge is going to be far deeper than that. One of the things that's important to recognize is right now PrEP is a medication that is protected by the government's patents and so on and so forth. That will end, and generic medication will be on the shelves. I want to say it's 2024, which will bring the cost down.
All right, Mr. Jude, did you want to chime in as well?
Sure do. We already actually have a generic for one of the medications for PrEP. The original medication that was approved is currently on the market, which is good. And so the costs before that generic were probably around, I would say, $2,000 average wholesale price per month. Now, keep in mind, we all know on this committee, we're smart enough to know that drug reimbursement costs, it's an opaque process. So exactly what the true cost is, I'm not sure. But that is, again, considered the standard, if you will, around 2000, maybe 1400 to 2000. And so again, that can, you know, accumulate over time. But again, as the generic for the first medication is now available, in the very beginning when generics hit the market, they're not that cheap. But because there's like a certain amount of time where they're allowed one generic to have exclusivity. And then over the coming years, as more and more competition is allowed, the price continues to pull down. So I'm hoping that the cost becomes much less over time. For post-exposure, again, that's when one is exposed and we need to do something immediately. That can also be quite expensive and upwards of $2,500 to $3,000. To make sure, but again, the backbone of that regimen is that which just went generic. So we're hoping that overall the costs will eventually start to come down for prevention. I should also address your, Madam Chairman, your previous statement too on the complexity. These are very guideline-driven thought processes. There's not too much gray room these days. It's almost always let's err on the side of caution to move ahead with post-exposure, especially in that setting. Even if the risk is low, oftentimes it provides a sense of comfort, to be honest, to those that might have had an exposure, even if it was a lower risk. As well, the medicines are typically very well tolerated. Very rare do patients have side effects that lead to discontinuation. So this is a much calmer situation than it was, let's say, 5 to 10 years ago.
Okay, and then
thank you. Yeah, and I know that Dr. Kasten wants to weigh in as well. Representative Munson?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess one of my other concerns based on what Representative Holland said on this bill is that it requires someone to have an HIV test performed and the results of that on file before you can even get a post-exposure drug. Is that correct?
So I'm going to actually go to Dr. Kasten, and if she can answer that as well as make the comment she wanted to make, and if not, then we'll go back to one of the other testifiers. Dr. Kasten?
Yes, so you do need a HIV negative test prior to starting PrEP or post-exposure prophylaxis. For post-exposure prophylaxis, you don't have to have the test back, but you need to be tested. For PrEP, you have to have the test back and know that the person is negative and that they can't have acquired HIV within the time they were tested and the time you start PrEP. As far as cost, I can't really talk specifically about cost, but what I can tell you, which is the USPTF, the US Preventive Task Force, which is a very conservative organization regarding guidelines that they put out, recommend PrEP for people who are at risk. And because of this now, most insurance companies will cover PrEP. So PrEP is standard of care for people like men who have sex with men and are at risk for HIV.
All right, thank you, Dr. Kasten. I see we've got another hand here from a member. We're gonna have to move on to the last bill. So Representative Bonner, can we have you comment on the next bill perhaps? Or did you have a question that had to go to this one?
It is specific to this one, but it's quick.
Okay.
My question is this. I am concerned about that test and particularly with the post and whether or not that's actually gonna be a barrier to care and if that's something that should be addressed or amended.
Mr. Jude?
Yes, I can speak to that. Thank you, Madam Chairperson. So I guess in this case, the tests are, I'm hoping that once this is approved, that once we're working in a collaborative practice or, you know, once we're able to provide the medications, that those tests will be available locally, that they're not gonna be something that we send out necessarily. I mean, again, everybody can do their own thing. With that, but to get that test, rapid testing is available for screening for HIV. I know that many of our organizations, public health organizations, use those frequently. So I'm hoping that that would not become a barrier because they are not that expensive, to be perfectly honest. I know even over the counter, you can just grab a rapid HIV test off the shelf at a large chain pharmacy for about $40. Now, again, that's retail price, right? Hopefully smaller, lower amounts would be, you know, manageable once a program gets up and running.
All right, thank you, Mr. Jude. We're gonna have to move on here because I wanna give the other bill an opportunity too. So thank you very much, Representative Hollins. The bill will be laid over. Let's see, House File 855 is laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. Thank you very much, Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam
and
Chair.
Testifiers. All right, so we're gonna move on to our final bill today, House File 1904, and it's Representative Bolden's bill. And she is on the committee, so it will be, oh, let's see, are we, I don't think we actually have the bill. So we're gonna do this as an informational hearing. So there is no motion as I understand it. Representative Bolden, is that correct? We don't have the bill yet.
Yes, Madam Chair, that's correct.
All right, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will give a brief overview of this bill and then turn it over to the testifiers. This bill has two main purposes. The first is to protect a class of HIV medications to ensure access to effective treatment for Medicaid and AIDS drug assistance program beneficiaries living with HIV and other serious, complex, chronic conditions that require timely and uninterrupted access to drug therapies, as we've been hearing about. Secondly, it would require the Department of Human Services to reform the existing Drug Formulary Committee to provide greater transparency and public participation. This bill provides regulatory protections from utilization management for the HIV drug class in the Medicaid AIDS Drug Assistance Program. I'll note that 25 states have similar protections of the HIV drug class and that HIV medication is one of six protected drug classes in Medicare. I think it's important to focus on what this would mean for Minnesotans living with HIV. This would ensure that no person living with HIV in Minnesota loses access to the medication that works best for them. It would maintain uninterrupted access to antiretroviral medications, which leads to people living with HIV achieving and sustaining undetectable status or viral suppression, meaning it cannot be transmitted to another person. Drug resistance can occur in people living with HIV, and this will allow them the ability to switch to another drug without interruption. In 2018, 36% of people living with HIV in Minnesota were not virally suppressed. Any changes to the medication access would increase this percentage. With access to HIV medications through the state and federal programs, we can end the HIV epidemic by 2025 in Minnesota. This bill would help us to continue to move in that direction. And now with your permission, Madam Chair, I will turn it over to the testifiers. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Ms. Bolden, Representative Bolden, I'm sorry. Okay, so we do just have a very few minutes, but pleased to have Alex Palacios. Welcome. Please just state your name for the record and if you're with anybody and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the committee for giving me a time to testify. My name is Alex Palacios. I use they, them pronouns. I am affiliated with the Aliveness Project. I do work as a member services director here. And I'm also affiliated with a few different organizations. But today I'm here before you as a consumer, as a person living with HIV. Who was diagnosed in August of 2015. And at that time, I didn't know terribly much about HIV, but I was given my first regimen of medications. And I was highly allergic to it. I broke out in hives. It was a miserable 2 weeks. And I thought, you know, this is just the medication doing its thing. I wasn't sure what to think. The point is, after two very long weeks, I went back to my doctor, resigned that I wouldn't take this medication anymore and that my health would start deteriorating. And, my doctor looked at me and said, absolutely not. We can just switch your medication. We can put you on something else that will do the trick without harming you. And so it was, and so it has been since then. The fact is that choice and access saved my life. My options were stop taking my medication and start deteriorating, right? Or switch medications. And to be able to do that easily, to be able to do that without barriers is incredibly important. As I mentioned, I now work at the Aliveness Project. I've worked in the outreach department for quite a bit of time, and I'm now member services director. This is not a barrier that was unique to me. It is so important that we give Minnesotans living with HIV every opportunity to be able to manage this condition and to, like me, be able to get to an undetectable status in this way, keeping our entire community safe and protected. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. And we're glad to see that this is working for you. That's good to know. Matt Toburin, did you want to say a few words on this bill? We just have 5 minutes left.
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Matt Toburin, he, him, Executive Director of the Aliveness Project, a community center for people living with HIV and AIDS. 4 years ago, this committee passed a bill to require DHS and MDH to develop a plan to end HIV in Minnesota. The bill ultimately passed unanimously, and Minnesota became a national leader in developing a coordinated response to ending the epidemic. One of the key findings and action items of this plan is the need to get more Minnesotans living with HIV connected to antiretroviral medications and support sustained adherence. We know that when someone living with HIV is on a successful medication regimen, they will achieve viral suppression, which means they can live a long and healthy life, and it's impossible to transmit the virus to someone else. Undetectable equals untransmittable. The most important thing we can do to end this epidemic is to remove barriers to accessing medication and support people staying adherent and remaining in care. And that is why we were shocked to learn on October 1st of 2020 that DHS Medicaid was moving to put some commonly used HIV medications on a non-preferred list, going against everything the department just declared was needed to end the epidemic. About one half of all people living with HIV in Minnesota get their health insurance coverage through Medicaid or the AIDS Drug Assistance Program. People living with HIV who have Medicaid coverage by virtue of qualifying for the program are low income and have significant existing barriers to care. At a time when we are working together vigorously to fight health disparities, access to vital medication should not be made more difficult for those populations most deeply affected. Never during the history of the AIDS epidemic has Minnesota tried to manage this drug class until now. There is longstanding medical and public policy precedent in protecting the HIV class from step therapy. HIV is one of six protected classes in the Medicare Part D program. And in addition, 25 states have some sort of legislative or regulatory carve-out protections ensuring an open HIV formulary, including most recently, the state of Texas. It's now time to include Minnesota on the list of those states and ensure that low-income Minnesotans do not face unnecessary barriers in accessing life-saving HIV medications. Thank you for your support for House File 1940, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. I'm going to give Representative Bolden the final word here because we're almost at time. Representative Bolden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will be brief and just thank the testifiers today for sharing their stories and this information and just underscore the importance of making sure that Minnesotans have access to these life-saving drugs.
All right, thank you, Representative Bolden. And as I said at the outset, we don't have possession of this bill, so we're just, it seemed to be a very good day to have this discussion with these other bills. And so thank you to all the testifiers today. This has been very informative, and we are waiting some fiscal notes here. And the bill that we were just discussing, House File 1904, is, I believe, in the Commerce Committee still. So we may yet see that bill come through to our committee. But with that, having no other business today, thank you to all the members and everyone who was here. We stand adjourned.